welcome to this week's edition of the X's and O's with Greg Cosell. That guy over there is Greg Cosell of NFL Films and ESPN's NFL Matchup. I'm Doug Farrar of Touchdown Wire and the USA Today Sports Media Group. And Greg, it's draft week. Oh my gosh, here we go. And we've done a lot of prospect evaluation. Certainly after the draft, we'll discuss, you know, scheme fits and team fits and all that and what teams have done and how they factor into all the trends. But I did want to get into a really trend-based and kind of conceptual-based concept this week, because you know how this goes. Teams are, you know, it's funny how a lot of teams give their guys, their people, I should say, the weekend off before the draft, like go home, see your family for the last
right,
time.
Right. Right.
Sort of get your brain, put your brain in the dishwasher, come back at 4 o'clock Monday morning and we're going to rock and roll. So,
and I think most draft boards are probably done by now anyway.
Pretty much. You might be waiting for one piece of information on how a guy worked in 13 personnel or how he got along with his uncle who coached him in high school, but you're pretty much there. Unless, you know, you have a situation where a guy gets busted for a DWI. we won't get into that. Anyway, so what I want to get into now is if you go back 10 years, and the advanced metrics services I have go back about that far, but you and I have been talking football at least that long. So if we go back to, say, 2014 to 2016, and we're using Pro Football Focus and Sports Info Solutions for this, so we have both, and SIS goes back to 2016 for all the relevant stats, which is still pretty definitive. How you evaluate players in the transition from the NCAA to the NFL, and you talk to a ton of coaches and GMs and scouts and all that, how teams evaluate positions differently than they did 10 years ago, going into this process and certainly refining it 4 days before the draft as we're doing this Monday morning Pacific time. Just kind of how things are different. And we're not going to discuss running backs, linebackers, and tight ends and how they're different, because I think that's kind of been done to death.
Okay.
You know, tight ends are now big receivers and running backs are rotational and, you know, linebackers have to be – we can get into that maybe over the summer. But – I want to talk about quarterbacks, receivers, guards, defensive tackles, cornerbacks, and safeties. And I want to start with quarterbacks. And well, go ahead.
Let's put quarterbacks and wide receivers somewhat together. But, I mean, they'll be different, but together. There's no question. And I've had these conversations at the Combine. I had a bunch this year, by the way, with a lot of offensive coaches. Obviously, what's happened over the last number of years, and I think it's probably – a function of what defenses do, but more and more coaches, particularly veteran coaches, I'm not talking about young coaches who've just, let's say, come from college into the league. I'm talking about coaches who've been in the league for many years. Mm-hmm. There's no question that in the spectrum of traits that they ascribe more value to than ever before is the ability to play above the X's and O's. Now, sure, that's not the number one trait, clearly. My guess is that being able to deliver the ball with precise ball location would be really close to the top of everyone's list, because sure, if you can't do that, you can be really good at a lot of things, but if you can't throw it where you want to, you really don't have very much. But the idea of being able to make plays outside the structure of the offensive play call at any given time in the game, perhaps maybe on third and longs where the defense has the tactical advantage with a lot of the things they can do with their multiple personnel packages and pressures. Sure. I think that more coaches place more emphasis now on the ability of a quarterback to make plays outside the structure of the play call, just because defenses kind of force you to have to do that at times. And if your quarterback truly can't do that, and I think we're getting to the point where even the quarterbacks who we view as, in quotes, pocket quarterbacks still have the ability to move now. You're not going to see many statues playing quarterback in the NFL. Even quarterbacks that we think of as pocket quarterbacks like Joe Burrow, they have really deceptive, fluid, easy movement. He's not going to make the same kinds of plays that Lamar Jackson's going to make or Josh Allen or even Patrick Mahomes, but there's no question that Joe Burrow can get outside the pocket, the parameters of the pocket, and make plays. So
he's also the best pocket mover in the league, and I will brook no argument.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair to a large extent. Yes. So I think that that is something that is clearly changed, certainly going back 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, God, I started NFL Films in July of 1979. I go back to when, you know, and you'll remember the name. Obviously, I'm a little older than you, but I remember when Steve Bartkowski was considered the prototype, 6'4", 225, drop back, big, you know, big physical looking guy, probably couldn't move, you know, at all, but boy, could he throw a football. And sure, he was, I think he might've been Lee Steinberg's first client too.
I think he was, and he wasn't he the first overall pick in his draft?
He was. Had a couple of really nice years with Atlanta. You know,
he was injured a ton. I always wanted Barkowski and that Gritz blitz defense from 77 in the same team.
Right. But I mean, I think with quarterbacks, that's clearly the case. If you go to wide receivers now, the reason I think that it sort of goes together, because this now has to do, I think, with the changing nature of pass games in the league. First of all, you are seeing more quicker game, whether it's RPO based or whether it's just quicker throws, you're seeing more quick game in the league. You're also seeing a lot more motion in the league. And what that means now, think back years. There's no way years and years ago that anybody would have thought of 170 or 175 or even 180-pound receiver being a first-round pick in a draft. Nope. Okay, Jordan Addison weighed 173 pounds at the combine last year, first-round pick. Zay Flowers, I think, was what, 182 maybe, something along those lines.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way 15, 20 years ago that receivers like that would have been considered, you know, high picks in a draft.
No, but now, and we'll put them on punt returns.
But now with the increase in motion, the increase in stacks, the increase in bunches, ways to get receivers free access off the ball. Tank Dell, obviously not a first round pick, but 155, 160 pounds. Remember the discussion we had about Devontae Smith coming out of Alabama a few years ago, and it was a legitimate conversation. It might seem silly now because he's proven to be really good, but I guarantee in draft rooms there were serious discussions about whether 160-pound rail thin receiver could really, you know, play at a high level in the NFL.
To break in, and it's a relevant Devontae Smith story. When Xavier Worthy was deciding to commit to a college, he committed to Texas. And this is per Dane Brugler, who does the Beast.
He's phenomenal, Dane. Absolutely,
my brain explodes every time I try to think about writing something like that. But Xavier Worthy, who could be a fringe first round pick at, you know, 165 in this class, he went to Texas specifically because he liked how Steve Sarkisian prepared Devontae Smith for the NFL as Alabama's OC. So when he went to Texas, Worthy said, hey, I'm going to do like as like. I want this guy to get me ready for the NFL in the same way that Devontae Smith was ready for the NFL.
And that's interesting because I've watched – Sarkisian has some really good clinics on YouTube, and I've watched a few of them. And he, you know, there's a lot of NFL concepts in what he does as well. You know, he's really good in the way he teaches it. You know, so he has that benefit as well going to Texas. You know, I think that that's where the receivers have changed. So you're going to see, look, you and I don't know where Xavier Worthy is going to get drafted. I'd have a hard time, without any inside information at all, I'd have a hard time if he was there when the Cowboys drafted, if he were to get past the Cowboys. But that's just a personal thought that I could be dead wrong. But no, guys like that are definitely considered first-round picks now, whereas, you know, 15, 20 years ago, even going back to 2014, I'm not sure a 173-pound receiver like Jordan Addison would have been considered a first-round pick.
No. Well, I remember writing a whole ass article after Devontae Smith was drafted, and everyone was saying, oh, you know, first time he hits press in the NFL, he's going to drop and blow away. And I'm thinking, yeah, maybe if you can catch him, if you can deal with the foot fakes in you know, trips and bunch and twins and all that and motion, sure, maybe you can do that.
Yeah, but you go back to maybe the greatest, you know, certainly one of the absolute greatest offensive football minds we've ever had in Bill Walsh.
Sure.
I mean, they played with a fullback all the time, played with two wide receivers. The only time they ever put a third wide receiver on the field was on third down. I think it was Mike Wilson, if memory serves me correctly. Yeah. The game is totally changed. And you had an X receiver and a Z receiver, and that's the way you played. You know, you didn't move people around. One guy lined up on one side, one guy lined up on the other side. There weren't stacks. There weren't bunches. I mean, this is how teams played back then. And, the game has changed to the point where I think the receiver position and what teams look for and are able to use effectively has you know, meaningfully changed.
Not to deviate too much because we got a lot to get to, but I always find it funny. And, Dan Marino was one of the five greatest quarterbacks of all time. But I always find it funny when people say, oh, in today's NFL with the new different rules favoring offenses, Dan Marino would throw for 12,000 yards a season. Yeah, if you look at defenses from 1985, and you look at a defense in 2023, the amount of stuff you have to wade through in your head is exponentially more now. I'm not saying Marino wouldn't be a top three quarterback today, but you know, there are so many reasons that things are different. So with that in mind, I want to start with,
well, it's all cyclical, by the way. You know, defense does something, offense responds. Offense does something, defense responds. I mean, you wrote a book about that. I mean, that's the way it works. You know, it's all, it's tactical. You know, it's you have to respond to what you're getting. I mean, that's the way it works if you want to keep being good.
Yeah. Well, you teed me up for quarterbacks and what I want to discuss at that position. And this is all, again, in the because it's draft week, we're talking about how you analyze and scout and sort of project quarterbacks and transition them. And I know we both do this in our scouting reports, because it's great to say, hey, the guy can do these four things, but it doesn't mean crap because he's coming into the NFL. What's his transition? So with quarterbacks, Sports Info Solutions has their advanced stats going back to 2015. So in 2015, Russell Wilson led the NFL to 117 attempts outside the pocket, 57 completions. Aaron Rodgers was second. Last season, Patrick Mahomes led the league with 118 attempts outside the pocket. Josh Allen ranked second. Overall, quarterbacks attempted 2,633 passes outside the pocket last season. There were 2,070 such attempts in 2016. So when we look at – and there's one more game now, but I did include postseason, so it's pretty close. I'm not saying teams are – quarterbacks are doing it more, but – how have the concepts changed for mobile quarterbacks over that time, and how has that affected the NFL's evaluation of them? I would say now, Greg, two things are happening, just in my opinion. The league is more accepting of quarterbacks, as you said, playing outside the X's and O's or above the X's and O's. But darn it, you had better be able to twist your body around and get your shoulders square and throw that target on the move. You can't be out there just, you know, improvising and what the heck. And when we think of those outside the pocket plays, it's not Patrick Mahomes making magic with scramble drills. I ever talked to Doug Baldwin, gosh, 12 years ago. And he said, yeah, me and Russ in Seattle, we practice scramble drills.
Of
we
course.
Practice everything falling apart and going outside the pocket. So if you're looking at quarterbacks just overall now and 10 years ago, how is it different? What things are important more than they were then, and what things are not? Like, what, you know, if a guy can't do something, maybe that's not as important as it was 10 years ago.
Well, my guess is, okay, I could be wrong, but my guess is if you got 25 quarterback coaches or coordinators together, they probably have the same 15 traits or whatever number of traits listed as, hey, these are traits that are important to me in evaluating a quarterback. So the issue then becomes is what value do you ascribe to those traits? And because you work for a team and there's other factors just beside the quarterback, is what really factors into what my team is, you know? So in other words, if you're a team that really wants to start your offense, you know, like let's say Arthur Smith might look at what's more important to him with a quarterback within those 15 traits differently than maybe Andy Reid does, or, you know, again, I don't know any of this for a fact, but I'm just saying, you know, based on what I see on film, looking at how they run their offense. But I would say that, you know, there'd probably be certain non-negotiables. In other words, that it'd be hard to play quarterback at a reasonably high level in the NFL if you couldn't do a couple of things. Okay. Number one, it starts with where you place the football. And we said that already. If you can't place the football where you want to place the football, it's going to be hard to play quarterback at a high level. Number two, no matter what your offensive scheme is, no matter what the defense is doing, and defenses have become a lot more multiple, you know, defenses throughout the course of a game play 19, 20 players, a lot of different packages, different pressure schemes, you know, come at you different ways.
Switching coverages pre and post snap, which, as we have said, has increased exponentially in the last even 5 years.
Correct. So as a quarterback, you have to be able, and this is a kind of a generic term, but it's the way it is. You have to be able to see things clearly. Whatever that means for a specific quarterback, you got to be able to see it. You know, whether it's pre-snap, whether it's post-snap, whatever it may be, you got to be able to see it. Because I'm not sure fans have a sense of how little time you have. You know, keep in mind that time starts, you know, you're in the huddle. Doug, you come out of the huddle, there might be 10 seconds left on the play clock, okay? The coach can't talk to the quarterback anymore because I think, what's that, turned off at 15 seconds, if I'm not mistaken? So now you come to the line of scrimmage. You're a young quarterback, okay? And now you're looking at the defense. Now, you're probably seeing a defense that's going to be a little different than a lot of defenses you've seen in college because you're a young quarterback. So now not only are you looking at the defense and seeing some things that are different, but also you're seeing that play clock winding down, and you've got to make sure everybody's lined up properly. You got to make sure the snap count works, all that works, and you still got to understand the defense, okay? Which is why a lot of coaches say it takes a good 3 years to really learn your offense and defenses, which is why it's so hard to change coaches, but that's a different conversation.
Yeah. And you probably, by the way, just to break in, you probably have a check like, okay, we're going to run this play against cover four. We're going to run this play against cover three.
Then it depends how much information you want to give to your young quarterback. Right. You know, so now that gets into something else as well. But the point is at some point as you're dropping back, you can't be on your second or third step and have no idea what you're looking at, you know, because now you have, depending on the play call, because think of it this way, Doug, three-step timing is 1.6 seconds to get rid of the ball. Mm-hmm. Five-step timing is 2.1 seconds. If it happens to be, let's say, a shot play, seven-step drop-back timing, it's 2.6 seconds. So think, you know, when everything's quick, and boy, when you're a young quarterback, that 1.6 seems probably like it's about, you know, 0.1 of a second. I mean, everything is happening so fast. This is stuff you have to kind of work through, and it takes time. It's not that easy. And that's why coaches work so hard to try to give quarterbacks their primary read. But the defense has a lot to say about that too. You know, and, you know, sometimes guys can handle that. Sometimes you don't see that in college. We've talked about that with Brock Purdy. Brock Purdy just has a natural.
Where on earth did his ability to see coverage switches come from? We still don't know.
I mean, he just has that natural feel for that, which you never saw at Iowa State, because the Big 12 is all that 3-3-5 stuff. There's not a lot of stuff going on with you know, defenses. So we didn't know he could do that. But it's really hard. So getting back to two things, you talk about accuracy, you're talking about whatever it is, you got to be able to see it, and you got to be able to see it fast. Because if you don't see it fast, what happens is the clock goes off in your head really fast because everything's speeded up to begin with. And then you're either just throwing it away or you're moving, you know, and then whatever happens, hey, if you've got the ability to move, you know, that's great. If you don't, then, you know, it could be a negative play or a throwaway.
Yeah, we've discussed it for like Philip Rivers, to me, Lock Hall of Famer eventually. How would teams view Philip Rivers now?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that.
Peyton Manning, how, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you're talking about Philip Rivers in particular, taking nothing away, obviously, from Peyton Manning. But Philip Rivers would just stand in the pocket. I mean,
he'd get the crap beaten out of him.
I remember talking to John Ramsdell, who was with Philip and with the Chargers, and just talking about just how tough Philip Rivers was. I mean, just oblivious to people around him. Just it was just innate. See, that's another thing. That's innate. You can't teach that.
No.
You can't teach that toughness in the pocket.
And I remember watching Mac Jones coming out of Alabama and thinking, I don't know if this is going to work because I don't think this guy can move. I don't think he has a second reaction to whether you and I just agree or disagree. I just thought, and my thought was like, can you even make it in the NFL without that second reaction ability? So
the question becomes, what's the balance now between second reaction and the ability to stand in the pocket and deliver the football?
Right.
I don't think there's a coach in the NFL that would say that the second reaction stuff is more important. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think a coach would say that. I think you still have to execute the offense.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to make throws from the pocket.
But going back to what you originally said about the playing above the X's nose, I think coaches, and they do this and they have to factor in the stuff that isn't in the play, if that makes sense.
I think defenses do the same thing. I mean, I've had great conversations with defensive coordinators where they talk about when they face how hard it is to face quarterbacks like Mahomes or like Lamar, because in a sense, you have to have two defenses. You have to have your defense for the structure of the play. And then you have to have a defense for what happens after the structure of the play. And that's really hard. I mean,
and think about Josh Allen. I mean, you have to deal with all that crap, and then he's bigger than your linebackers. I mean, what do you do now?
Right. So, I mean, it's, you know, and that's, but, you know, and maybe I'm old school, probably because I'm old, but I still think somewhere along the line, coaches are going to say that, you know what, if the throw is there in the context of the pass game, you got to, from the pocket, you got to deliver the football.
Oh, sure.
You can't live on a pass game as good as Mahomes is. And you know, he's the best in the business right now, clearly. As good as Josh Allen is, as good as Lamar is. Okay. Yeah. And these guys just have a feel. I mean, that's the thing. There's a feel here that you can't really be taught. You can work with a guy, but I think there's a certain feel on how you see it. And you know, not to be negative, but maybe someone like Justin Fields, you know, I'm not around him, but maybe he doesn't have that feel. And he's super given. You could argue Justin Fields, just from sheer talent, is top five in the league, maybe top three in the league. But, you know, the sense is that he just doesn't see it the way you need to see it, you know, the right way or within the time allotted. I guess we'll find out as his career goes on.
Yeah, because ball location you talked about, I mean, you can be built like Khalil Mack and run like Michael Vick, and if you can't locate the ball in the time of the play where you want to, it doesn't matter. Yeah, I think to conclude, tell me if this is off base at all, you as an NFL evaluator and in the transitive properties of these quarterbacks, you know, like, yeah, because I remember C.J. Stroud getting debited because he couldn't move, and everyone flipped out about it until the Georgia game. Oh, he can move. Okay, now it's fine. But I think Stroud is a perfect example of, you know, that ability to win from the pocket. But when he gets outside the pocket, he's still thinking as a pocket passer to a degree.
Yeah.
So and that holistic balance between the two is what you really are looking for.
Well,
and as the NFL becomes more accepting of those mobile quarterbacks, it's like, okay, the fact that you can run around doesn't mean crap. You have to still be a quarterback wherever you are.
And just talking about Stroud, by the way, I watched probably 8 or 9 Stroud games from his last year at Ohio State, and he moved better. You know, for people who aren't studying him in detail, the Georgia game seemed to be the coming out party, but that was not true if you watched him all year long, which obviously I did in evaluating him leading up to the draft. But
it was a good way to tell who had watched him and who hadn't. Let's put it that.
But the point is now you're getting into another element, and we could talk just about quarterbacks, quite frankly. But
I know.
I'm cutting
some stuff out from other positions as we go.
Right.
Because it's such an important
and by stuff. The way, it's probably what most people are interested in, particularly in this draft, where it's possible that 4 quarterbacks could be the first 4 picks, which would be the first time in history. But anyway, the point I'm making about Stroud, and I noticed it week 2 against Indy, really noticed it in the league. I mean, is now you're getting into the anticipation element, because guys who have a great sense of anticipation. And anticipation comes from understanding your route concepts and immediately and intuitively understanding the defense, okay? And I'm talking in particular against zone. Man is different. Man is, hey, you know, that it's man. But it's more against zone. Is that helps you also play more efficiently from the pocket, because now you're throwing the ball early. So that helps you to defeat the pass rush too. So now it also helps you not have to deal with as many noisy, muddied pockets, because the ball's coming out, you know. So, you know, there's the anticipation factor. And sometimes that's hard to see in college as well, because of the nature of the college pass games. The field is wider. The wide side of the field in college is really wide. You can always make throws in college football if you want to, you know, to. It's really hard to defend the wide side of the field in college football.
Coverages aren't nearly as complicated. I mean, I know we came with Bo Nix a few weeks ago, and he said, yeah, we have some interesting stuff in the Pac-12. It's like, yeah, okay, Bo, but still, it's not the same.
I mean, I always tell this story, and Kevin O'Connell, he's the one who told me, so, you know, I'm sure he said it not only to me, but he was in our broadcast boot camp before he decided he wanted to go in coaching, and we kind of hit it off, and in fact, during free time in the boot camp for those 4 days, he said to me, hey, can we go to your office and watch tape? You know, deep down, he probably knew he wanted to be a coach. But I remember talking with him, and he said to me, hey, you know, I came out of San Diego State. I played in a pure spread offense, and everything was spread out. He said, I got to New England. He was a third-round pick of the Patriots. And he said to me, God, the whole game was different. Yeah, I had to make throws in the middle of the field. He said, I thought there were 15 defenders out there. You know, and I think that that's something that's also hard to you either can see that, or you, like Stroud, can see that. He just can see it naturally. You know, some guys as gifted as they might be throwing a ball, running around, doing all that, they don't see it. It just doesn't register, because you've got to make more throws in the middle of the field far and away in the NFL than you have to in college football.
Exactly. Let's move to receivers here. I wanted to get into slot, but the quarterback discussion was important and very instructive. Thank you. I'll just mention in 2023, there were 7,519 slot targets where the target was a receiver in motion. In 2016, there were 7,621. So the number's about the same. Where it gets different is pre-snap motion. In 2016, there were 1,080 instances in which a receiver was targeted out of pre-snap motion. In 2023, there were 2,126 such plays. So more than twice the amount of a target in motion than there was even in 2016. So this is now, as you said, a primary construct of modern passing games. How does this change the ways, besides the fact that 170-pound guys are now acceptable as, like, number two receivers, how does this change the ways in which the guys getting those targets are evaluated?
I don't know. I'm sure it does. But see, I think of motion more as how it impacts the defense, Doug, because, I think, quite frankly, that one of the things, and I had a great talk with a defensive coordinator who's been in the league for a really long time, one of the most respected in the league, and we had a great talk about motion. And one of the first things he said to me, and that's why I think about this more from a defensive perspective than an offensive perspective. I mean, I think as far as receivers, you could theoretically put any receiver in motion. I mean, look, let's start with the receivers. It all relates back to a number of different things. The fact that they're smaller, okay? But what you're trying to do with motion, not 100% of the time, but a good percent of the time, is give receivers free access off the ball. Yep. Because it's harder to press receivers who are in motion. It's hard to do that. Yep. So now you get free access off the ball, and they can scream off the line of scrimmage. It doesn't disrupt the timing of your pass game between quarterback and receiver, and your pass game can stay more in rhythm. But the reason I think it's more impactful for your defense is, and what it does to a defense is, it's really hard with motion to start making a ton of communication adjustments on the defensive side of the ball.
Yes.
Because now with motion, there's so many other factors that come into play. Is motion changing the strength of your offense? Is motion jet motion, which theoretically is not changing the strength of your offense? You know, there's that short motion now that we saw the Dolphins do a lot of with Tyreek Hill, where he stayed on the same side and he just motioned out, and, you know, short burst motion. I'm sure teams have different names for it. You know, so there's all kinds of motion, but the bottom line is, defensively, what it often does is it shrinks your defensive menu. Yes. And that's what offenses are looking for. They're looking for the defense to be predictable as much as it can be for the quarterback. They would love the quarterback to have as much information as possible before the ball snapped, not have to figure it out as he's dropping back, because then the time crunch becomes a major deal. Okay. So motion shrinks your defensive menu because it's hard to communicate. You don't want three guys. You know, I mean, some teams, as soon as there's motion, you see, you know, if it's single high, you see one safety racing back, the other safety racing down, or you see linebackers starting to bump. And, you know, I mean, you start to see four guys move. You start to see that many guys move on defense. All it takes is for one guy to be wrong or to be late. And all of a sudden, it could be a 60-yard touchdown. And that's
this is obviously why teams play more quarters now, because you have everything sort of.
Well, quarters is balanced. You don't really have to react theoretically to motion if you're in quarters, because it's a balanced coverage.
Right.
Okay. Unlike single high, where you have a strong and a weak. Quarters is more balanced.
Right.
So you're seeing more quarter structure to start, you know, because you don't have to really do a whole lot necessarily. You know, obviously, I'm not a defensive coach, and they're a lot smarter than I am. So
I mean, Vic Fangio probably has 30 different iterations of quarters, because Vic Fangio is a genius. But
yeah, and he's a lot smarter than I am. So, you know, I'm not going to pretend I know the answer to that. But the point is it does shrink your defensive menu when you use motion, and that's what what offenses want. They want the defense. They know from film study with any given team, particularly if it's in their division, let's say, when they study these teams in detail in the offseason, they know that, hey, if we go in motion, they're going to end up defaulting to one of two defenses, one of two coverages. Maybe it's cover two, maybe it's core, whatever it may be. But they're going to know that from film study, and then the quarterback knows that.
Well, and also if they're a heavy press team and they're using press to counter quick game to disrupt the receiver, because you don't have time to disrupt the quarterback, like, well, we're going to motion the crap out of these guys because now you can't play press. So, you
it's
know, that's another
press. Yeah. Because
one thing I would say real quick, because I don't want to.
That's another way the game's changed, though. I'm sorry, is that you're seeing a lot of teams and a lot of defensive coaches, and one in particular who I know well, talk about the fact that they almost view corners now as more important than edge rushers because, you know, obviously if it's third and long, edge rushers are important. But in the overall scheme of a game, it's you want to be able to disrupt receivers because, you know, three-step drops, RPOs, quick game, you're not getting to the quarterback.
Right. Well, we'll get into – let's go to – I could talk about this for all of this stuff. I didn't realize.
Well, you know what, Doug? Well, we'll do one more now, and then we'll get back to this after the draft, you know, in the summer, because this is conceptual football.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to tie two things together, and it has to do with quick game, and it has to do with getting the ball out in a hurry, and it's guards and defensive tackles. We have a different set of numbers when discussing offensive guards. In 2024, there are 6 left guards and 8 right guards, the cap hit of over $10 million. In 2014, there was one, Jari Evans of the Saints. Now, if you have one or two good seasons as a guard, either another team will come and snap you up in free agency, or the team for whom you put up all that good tape will pay you seriously. And how much of that is due to the increasing use of quick game in the NFL and the fact that guards are tasked to do different things, not only with more aggressive defensive tackles as pass rushers, but the increasing development of multi-gap pass rushers and the stunts and games they use. If you watch the Cowboys last year with their stunts, oh my God. It was like 2 or 3 different stunt concepts.
Yeah, well, they stunted as much or more than any team in the league.
And with the Dan Quinn going to the Commanders, that's going to be a thing for them.
Well,
just real quick. Now it seems as if guards are asked to do as much as tackles are in their own ways, and we haven't really even discussed the run game yet. And I know you say, and it's true, tackles control the width of the pocket. And guards
and centers control the depth.
So the depth of the pocket is where defenses are trying to make quarterbacks vulnerable in those more quick game concepts, because you don't have time to make quarterbacks vulnerable from the width to the depth. It doesn't, you know.
Well, plus quarterbacks can defeat width pressure by stepping up, but if they can't step up, then that's a problem. But the other factor
too. Tom Brady versus Justin Tuck in those 2 Super Bowls, Brady couldn't step up. There you go.
Yeah. Well, the other factor, too, is what are we seeing more and more of in the NFL with quarterbacks? Shorter quarterbacks. Quarterbacks need – I mean, for years it was all Drew Brees. It seemed like he was the only quarterback that was 6 feet. And what did Sean Payton do? Sean Payton focused on the interior of his offensive line with the center and
his right guard. He was really good. And Jari Evans could move up to the third level, or he could do it
right. So now you're seeing more. I mean, even guys coming out in this draft, you know, Caleb Williams appears to be the number one pick, but he's only 6'1". Now, you know, he has a certain set of traits that, you know, are different. You know, obviously he can move around. But the point is, you still have to have a drop back passing game to some degree. And, you know, so now not only does quick game matter, but, you know, these are shorter quarterbacks. So they need space in front of them. And so now your center and your 2 guards become, you know, I don't want to say more important. That, again, that gets back to all the traits now that teams look at, but they become very, very important because, you know, I mean, think of Bryce Young, the number one pick in the draft last year. Bryce Young, right about just under 6 feet, I think it was. I can't remember exactly. You know, and he's a guy that does not have a big gun. He needs space in front of him. And if memory serves me correctly, because I'm so far removed from free agency, it seemed like it happened 5 years ago. But I believe they signed 2 guards. Did they not in free agency?
Well, they signed Robert Hunt. I know that.
I thought they signed another guard. Didn't they sign Lewis from Seattle?
Yes, but Robert Hunt, the right guard.
They gave a ton of money. But the point is, they had to address the guard position because of their quarterback.
Yes.
Because their quarterback needs space in front of him because he's a shorter quarterback. And no matter whether you're doing quick game or regular game, he needs space.
And shorter quarterbacks, I mean, not always, Josh Allen being, you know, Josh Allen or Cam Newton. If you're 6'5", that's a lot of moving parts. shorter quarterbacks can be sort of quicker, more efficiently in a general sense. So that's maybe another reason. I don't know. I'm extrapolating there. But that's – so we move to defensive tackles. In 2014, Greg, J.J. Watt led the league among players termed interior defensive line with 21 sacks and 119 total pressures. It's good. He had a three-year stretch. We talk about Aaron Donald, and, like, you guys are forgetting how good J.J. Watt was. At his peak, he was every bit what Aaron Donald was. But Watt lined up
– he was such a different player because of his size.
Right. Watt lined up outside, Greg, on 659 of his snaps, over the tackles on 380, and the B-gap on 8 snaps. So if we're looking at the most pressure guys back then who were actually interior defensive linemen, there's Ndamukong Suh with 9 sacks and 63 total pressures. You're Sheldon Richardson, Stephen Paella, the bench press king, Tyrone Crawford, Fletcher Cox, who I know you know well, Gerald McCoy, and back in 2014, this rookie named Aaron Donald. In 2023, Chris Jones of the Chiefs led the league among interior defensive line with 15 sacks and 91 total pressures. Justin Madubuike was right up there with 15 sacks. Both of those players were actually primary interior defenders. There are so many more prolific interior pass rushers, Greg, who can move around to different gaps, but they're not really – wouldn't call Chris Jones or Madubuike a hybrid guy, even though they might line up outside 25% of the time. They're interior defenders first and foremost, and the rest is really good frosting. 7 interior defensive linemen last season had 10 or more sacks. In 2014, Watt was the only one, and he wasn't really an inside guy. So how are these players able to create so much more havoc, starting with the tackles inside shoulder? And by the way, the Rams had another rookie on that list with Kobe Turner, who I voted for as defensive rookie of the year. So 10 years later, they're still getting guys in the draft pretty good. But, I mean, it's such a sea change. And we can talk about the stunts and the multiple fronts and all that. But there are these 300-pound guys now, Greg, who can just effing demolish your pocket. And that wasn't really – you have your Joe Greens and your all-timers, but that wasn't true – and then you get Dexter Lawrence, who's 360 pounds, and he's that quick. It's just terrifying. So we'll conclude this show, and we'll get to other – because this is – I'm glad I came up with this, because we have a lot to – it's been a
Well, you're getting defensive tackles, too, that are all shapes and sizes.
Right.
You're getting the big guys like Chris Jones. You mentioned Watt, obviously. Then you're getting smaller guys. I mean, Aaron Donald's the prime example. In this year's draft, you've got Byron Murphy coming out of Texas. You got Johnny Newton coming out of Illinois. You're getting smaller guys. Now, there have been those guys in the league for sure. You have Grady Jarrett. I mean, one guy who comes to my mind was Geno Atkins in Cincinnati, you know, who is really, really – you can go back to John Randall. I mean, you know, I mean, there's always been smaller, quicker guys because they're really hard to block. There's just too much quickness inside for 320-pound offensive guards. I mean, I remember having a great conversation. This goes back years. It's funny. I had a great conversation with John Fox, who I still believe coaching. I think he's with Detroit as a consultant, if I'm not mistaken. Foxy is there. But the point is, you know, he said, and this goes back probably 10, 12 years, maybe it's still true. You know, he said that the biggest mismatch in the NFL is pass rushing D linemen versus offensive linemen. You know, it's just and offensive linemen are obviously getting more athletic, but you're talking about guys like Chris Jones, Madubuike. You know, these guys are really athletic studs for the size that they are.
Yeah.
I mean, they're hard to block.
So how, I guess, how has that changed in the last 10 years? In your opinion, why are there so many more guys who are legitimate three techs and four eyes and two eyes? And even, you know, Madubuike had some snaps at nose where he was just demolishing people.
Well, he also lined up at wide nine at times for Baltimore this year.
Is this just natural evolution, or are there things you've seen in the league that make this so much more possible?
I don't know if I have a brilliant answer for that, you know, because they're still smaller guys too, like we mentioned. I mean, it's not as if it's just moved generally in one direction. You know, I don't think there's 100 Chris Joneses. I mean, there's not a lot of guys 6'5", 322 who are Chris Jones, you know. Those guys are really hard to find. I mean, you know,
but they're hard to find, but there are so many more of them.
Well, I mean, are there really that many more of them?
When I was putting the research together, it appeared to me as such.
I mean, guys
over 290 who are not outside players who can legitimately put up 10 sack, you know, 80 pressure seasons.
Right. Yeah, I mean, again, I don't have a list of teams right in front of me, you know, with all the players and, you know, but I don't know. I'm not sure if there's if there's truly more of them, or if just the guys who are really good make it seem like there are more of them. You know, Matabuke seemed like he came out of nowhere this year.
He kind of did.
And no one was talking about Matabuke before this season, and he was a dominant player this year. You know, we know about Chris Jones. How many other 6'5", 300-pound-plus guys are there in the league right now that are those kinds of players? Maybe there are a ton more, and I'm missing them. But I don't really think there's that many of them.
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on back and forth on that. We're at our 40-minute mark, which means we got to go, and I know you got a lot of stuff to go on. We will continue this with other positions after the draft.
These are great conversations.
I love it, and it's kind of our summer stock where we get into.
Talk corners and safeties. You know, that'll be a half hour in and of itself.
That might be one for corners and one for safeties I got a lot of notes. But as always, Greg, great stuff. Really appreciate your time, especially this week because we're both going nuts trying to get it all done. And we'll talk to you on the other side of the draft, my man. If we're still here, if we survived it, we'll talk again next week on the X's and O's.
Thanks, Doug.